This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Congress lets big banks resume risky trades, rolling back financial reforms enacted to prevent another financial crisis.
When Wall Street, the CEOs of Wall Street, engaged in illegal and reckless behavior, which drove this economy into the worst recession in modern history, impacting millions and millions of people's lives, what happened to Wall Street? Well, Congress bailed them out. Congress bailed out the folks on Wall Street whose criminal action caused the recession. In my very strong opinion, we have reached the stage with Wall Street that the major financial institutions are just too big, they are just too powerful, and anyone who thinks that Congress regulates Wall Street has got it backwards. Because the reality is that Wall Street, with their incredible wealth and lobbying capabilities and campaign contributions, Wall Street regulates the United States Congress. And you cannot see a better example of it than what is in this legislation. Recent article, New York Times, in this provision, banks lobbyists help in drafting financial bills. And Mr. President, without objection, I would like to enter this article into the record.
Without objection.
Quote, in a sign of Wall Street's resurgent influence in Washington, Citigroup's recommendations were reflected in more than 70 lines of the House Committee's 85-line bill, two crucial paragraphs prepared by Citigroup in conjunction with other Wall Street banks were copied nearly word for word. In other words, it's not even members of Congress writing these bills. It is Wall Street writing the bills and getting them into this legislation. Now, what does this legislation do? We suffered the worst economic crisis since the 1930s because of the greed, recklessness, and illegal behavior on Wall Street. What Wall Street did is engage in absolutely reckless speculation. Then the chickens came home to roost. People could not pay back the debts that they incurred on subprime mortgages. And the entire financial system of the United States of America and the world was on the verge of collapse. So Congress a few years ago passed Dodd-Frank, didn't go anywhere near as far as I would go. I believe we should break up these major financial institutions. I don't believe you can control them. I don't believe you can regulate them. They regulate the Congress. But Dodd-Frank took some steps forward. And there was one provision, and I will quote, Section 716. And, Mr. President, I would ask unanimous right to put this into the record.
Without objection, so ordered.
And this is what it says, 716. This is the title of the provision that this bill repeals. Quotes, prohibition against federal government bailouts of swap entities. A, prohibition on federal assistance. Notwithstanding any other provision of law, including regulations, no federal assistance may be provided to any swaps entity with respect to any swap, security-based swap, or other activity of the swaps entity, end of quote. That is what is being repealed. So Wall Street, as a result of the work of Citigroup and the other Wall Street companies, can now continue to engage in reckless derivative speculation, and when they make a whole lot of money, they get richer. But when they lose money, because of the repeal of this provision, it is the taxpayers of this country who have to bail them out. Does anybody think that that makes any sense at all? That's in this bill. So, Mr. President, for those reasons and more, I would hope very much that the Senate rejects this agreement, that we renegotiate. No one wants to see the government shut down, but that we negotiate an agreement that is much fairer to the American people and to the working families of our country. And with that, Mr. President, I would yield the floor.
And that was Senator Bernie Sanders on the floor of the U.S. Senate railing against the provision that Citibank actually wrote, which was enacted into law, which waters down the financial reform, the Dodd-Frank bill, which tried to prevent the recurrence of the financial crisis.
Well, big banks attached a measure to must-pass congressional spending legislation which halted a restriction on their kinds of risky derivatives trading that blew up the U.S. economy in 2007. It allows the banksters to gamble not only with other people's money, but with taxpayers' guarantees for their losses.
This is only the beginning of this planned rollback of financial reforms passed to prevent another great recession. Liberal Democrats responded by calling for the breaking up of the too big to fail banks. But is this enough?
Well, I don't think so. But more importantly, Timothy Canova, professor of law and public finance, Shepherd Board Law Center, Nova, Southeastern University. Just to get this started, so deja vu all over again, is that where we're headed? The same practices of the banks that brought us the Great Recession? Is that the path that's being followed?
Well, nobody knows, but quite possibly that's where we're heading. You know, we watch as oil market has some wild fluctuations. In just the past few weeks, oil going from $100 a barrel to under $60 a barrel. And that's an opportunity that's rife for derivatives. And one has to wonder to what degree derivatives have been betting against oil, to what degree some of the derivative players have been trying to work behind the scenes to collapse the price of oil. So nobody really knows. There's not that much more transparency in the system since Dodd-Frank. And even the provision that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren were so concerned about, it really doesn't do all that much. But I do think it's very symbolic that in this Cromnibus bill, Congress moved in the wrong direction.
What was the provision that was passed? What exactly does it do?
It would have required bank holding companies to so-called push out some of their derivative contracts into subsidiaries. So the bank holding companies are insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The theory of this provision was by pushing out some of the riskiest of derivative contracts into uninsured subsidiaries, it would relieve the taxpayer from possible liability should those contracts implode and the subsidiary become insolvent. It only dealt with 5% of the derivative contracts, so about 95% of derivatives would still be in these FDIC-insured bank holding companies. And there was a number of other reasons to question even how effective this so-called push-out provision would have been. Other provisions of Dodd-Frank essentially make these clearinghouses, the clearinghouses that clear the derivatives trades, they deem them to be financial markets utilities. And that means they might be propped up by the federal government. They essentially become systematically important financial institutions. So there was an awful lot of heat in this debate, and yet I'm not quite sure how effective this push-out provision ever really would have been at the end of the day.
Well, do you think that it, though, encourages banks to do more financially risky trading because it makes them more profitable and perhaps give them access to a larger pool of money to play with?
Yes, yes. And, of course, the banks wanted the push-out provision removed. So right there it raises suspicions that push-out was going to limit them to some degree. And the push-out provisions are supposed to deal with the riskiest type of swap agreements. So to the degree those swaps are back on the bank's balance sheets and banks that are insured by the FDIC, it does indeed encourage or will encourage risky trading at the taxpayer expense. If these trades blow up in the faces of these bankers, you know, the FDIC might be on the hook.
If I can contextualize this a little and go back, certainly to many of us, it appears that the banks emerged from the crisis that they created largely unscathed, and that really there was de minimis regulation. Is that what indeed occurred and what's setting the pace now for these advantages or abuses that the banks are, or Wall Street demands for the derivatives deregulation?
Yes, that's my view. When you take a look at the response to the implosion of 2008, the largest banks got propped up. They got propped up by a number of means. The Treasury Department administer the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, the so-called bank bailout, pumping about $400 billion into these large institutions. And at the same time, the Federal Reserve opened up its discount window and made loans at virtually zero interest rates to these enormous institutions. And, I mean, they opened up that discount window wide, something like $16, $17 trillion in loans during the height of the crisis. And the Federal Reserve also did them the favor of purchasing a lot of mortgage-backed securities from their balance sheet, relieving them of mortgage-backed securities at a time when the mortgage market and the market for mortgage securities, mortgage bonds, was really quite depressed. So the biggest banks got propped up. They didn't get cleaned out. The same CEOs who were running the banks, the same management echelon, essentially were allowed to stay in place for the most part. And it's quite a contrast. Look at the way other countries have dealt with banking crises in the past. One that I've spoken about before, and partly because I spent some time in Sweden, was the response of the Swedish authorities to the collapse of their banking industry in the 1990s. Sweden also had a real estate bubble that collapsed, and the three largest banks, which really controlled much of the Swedish banking sector, those banks collapsed, and the Swedish government did not prop them up, bail them out, keep the bankers in place. They essentially took them over and swept out the old management, put government officials in place to clean up the bank, to these three banks, to investigate the kinds of trading practices that were taking place, to reform the trading practices. And when the banks were finally made solvent again, they privatized some of these banks. So that would have been a much wiser model for us to follow than what we did. In fact, when you look back to these critical weeks in late 2008 and early 2009, you had some very interesting voices calling for nationalizing the big banks, including Alan Greenspan, the disgraced Federal Reserve Chairman, Lindsey Graham, U.S. Senator from South Carolina. Those are people on the right.
Lindsey Graham actually called for the nationalization?
In the Financial Times, there was a, you know, he was somewhat contrite and apologetic for his role when he testified to Congress. There was this moment where there really was an opportunity for some reform. And ironically, it was people more in the center of the spectrum, people like Timothy Geithner, who said, no, we don't nationalize in this country. It's not part of our political culture. So instead, I guess it's part of our political culture to just prop up failed bankers and let them continue to reap huge rewards at everyone else's expense.
Well, it certainly is. And, I mean, I would have put a lot of them in jail, but that's another question.
Well, it's a related question. When you look at the federal government's response to the savings and loan collapse when George Herbert Walker Bush was president, there was a vigorous prosecution effort made, and over 1,000 savings and loan executives did time in prisons.
Well, I'd like to go back to the idea of nationalizing a bank, because you talked about Sweden, but then basically what you said is they nationalized it, got up the house back in order, and they gave it back to the private sector.
Yeah.
But I know that you're an advocate of what is called a public option for banks, which would keep them and do it right.
Well, that's right. When we look back in American history to the financial collapse surrounding the Great Depression and the response to the Great Depression, one of the institutions that really led us out of the Depression was the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. And in many ways, that was like a federally chartered infrastructure bank. It was a revolving fund that made over $50 billion in grants and loans, and a good portion of it was for works projects and infrastructure building during the 1930s. And even into the 1940s, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation helped to build major war industries and industrial plants. When Bill Clinton campaigned, he had called for an infrastructure bank, and so did Barack Obama in 2008 when he campaigned for the White House. The problem is these guys get into the White House and they forget completely about infrastructure banks.
Tim, I was wondering if you might tell us your position or opinion on what is prevalent in some other countries, and that is postal banking, and how useful or significant, or whether that could be a counter to these colossi vampire squids. They were referred to, granted it was Lehman Brothers and others, but I still think of them as, they're all part of the vampires.
There are a number of countries that have
vampire squid.
Yeah, that's Goldman Sachs, right? There are a number of countries that have very extensive postal banking systems. Their postal systems also serve as banks, mostly for lower income folks. For retail banking, Japan is one of the leading countries, but there are several countries in Europe as well. And in the United States, post offices for decades perform those kinds of banking functions for small depositors. And you take a look at what are called the unbanked part of the population, lower income folks who really can't even afford to open up a checking account. The fees end up hitting them very hard. I think the big banks that you're talking about, the giant squids, have been making something in the order of $30 to $40 billion a year just on bank fees that are charged mostly to lower-income people who can't keep those minimum deposits. So there are a number of proposals now for the U.S. postal system to start providing financial services, essentially retail banking, limited retail banking. And the Inspector General of the postal system came out with an interesting report some months ago. The postal system would start making money at the same time if it were doing this, at a time when it's the postal system is under a lot of going through some difficult times, in part because Congress has required the postal system to prepay their pension funds, unlike what the private sector has to do. So the postal system has been at a competitive disadvantage for quite some time. And this would be a win-win situation if we had postal banking in this country. It would provide better retail banking services for low-income folks, and it would be at least some source of income for the postal system itself. And we've seen public sector banks in this country from time to time really fill the vacuum that develops when the private banking system just caters to large corporations and ignores Main Street interests, small and moderate income or small and moderate-sized businesses and mortgage borrowers. North Dakota has a public bank. The Bank of North Dakota has been around for over a century and has been making a profit the whole time. And in large part because of that, North Dakota was the only state in the country that didn't suffer a budget deficit any time during the last 6 years, while many other states were way in deficit and were cutting back on their teachers and other essential public services. Public options make a lot of sense at the federal level. Again, an infrastructure bank makes a lot of sense. There are state infrastructure banks. They're generally not well funded. And the Federal Reserve should be a public bank. But it's really not. It has semblance on the outside of being, you know, a federal bank, as the name federal in its name, but it's essentially a privately directed and privately owned central bank. It serves the interests more often of Wall Street than of Main Street, and that, again, can be contrasted with how the Fed conducted its operations during the 1930s, when it actually made a significant amount of loans to small and moderate-sized businesses, to Main Street itself, during the Great Depression.
Well, the Congress would need to be convinced of that, and I wish they were convinced of it, but it seems as if in this last session, not only did they roll back parts of the Dodd-Frank financial reform, but they also rolled back funding for the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which cut their budget, and they're the ones that enforce these financial regulations.
Mm-hmm. And, I believe they also cut back the budget for the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Oh, I hadn't heard that. But
and the Environmental Protection Agency. This Cromnibus bill is just a small taste of what's to come over the next 2 years, I believe.
And do you think, in addition to some of the financial papers are saying, that there'll be more rollback of the financial reforms in the form of Dodd-Frank?
I would be shocked if there's not. I think President Obama is going to be faced time and again with some tough choices, whether to veto spending bills and perhaps shut down the government, or to accept spending bills that have these provisions in them that are litmus tests for conservatives, for Republicans in this country, such as, like we're talking about, cutting back on Dodd-Frank, environmental protection, and other progressive programs.
Timothy Canova, give us a sense of what the practical implications for Main Street are. the many main streets in this country with these continuous strengthening and opportunism of the banking sector?
Well, I think it's going to continue to be a two-tier economy where these are the best of times for the top 1%, or maybe we should say the top one-tenth or two-tenths of 1%. They've never had better times than this, but for much of the rest of the economy, much of the rest of the nation, this is a very tepid recovery. The Obama administration has been trumpeting the declining unemployment rate, but any serious analyst who takes a look at it will see that an awful lot of these jobs that are being created are part-time jobs that don't have benefits, that don't have any kind of security. It is a lousy, lousy jobs market right now. Forbes magazine had a piece that said the U6 unemployment rate, which really includes discouraged workers and part-time workers who want full-time work, we would have an unemployment rate closer to 13%. This is not a strong recovery, and as long as the system is structured the way it is, it's going to be very easy for large corporations to have access to credit for mergers and acquisitions and increasing concentration in fewer and fewer hands, which is the trend we've seen in banking but also in corporate America. And for Main Street, it's going to remain a difficult time. People want to start their own family businesses, small businesses. It's going to be very difficult to get the kind of credit that they want to start a business or maintain a business. And this is just the nature of the game where you have a central bank that is really co-opted by Wall Street interests, and you've got an increasing concentration of financial assets in the hands of just the largest Wall Street banks. It's a trickle-down economy. And, you know, we usually use the phrase trickle-down to refer to fiscal policy and, in fact, tax cutting for wealthy people. But it's a trickle-down monetary and banking policy as well.
And just very quickly, do you think that this means that there's an increased risk of another financial crisis?
I think so. And so many serious economists and commentators, from Simon Johnson to Krugman and Stiglitz and many others, and not just on the left, a lot of economists on the right of the spectrum, I think if they would say that the system hasn't changed that appreciably, there's still an awful lot of gambling going on in the casino. This is the problem with the derivatives market. We're talking about many, many trillions of dollars in wagers that are going on. That means a lot of betting on bubbles and busts. I think we've been fortunate that there hasn't been another financial collapse since 2008, but the stock market's at an all-time high. The oil market's collapsing. So whether you're talking about commodities or asset prices, there's still wide gyrations, and there's a lot of risk in this financial system.
Well, we're going to leave it there, but continue to follow this closely, and I can't think of anybody better to do that with than Timothy Canova, Professor of Law and Public Finance, Shepherd Board Law Center, Nova, Southeastern University.
And we end as we began with Senator Bernie Sanders.
The banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that my brother sweated for.
Throughout most of human history, society has been divided between the few who have enormous wealth and enormous power, and the many who struggle each day just to survive. The rich get richer, traveling about in their chauffeured limousines and jet-setting their way around the world to their exotic vacation places. And the poor get poorer. Hundreds of millions of people throughout this planet, in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, now face starvation, while millions more in our own country sleep out on the streets. Most of the people in this world work hard their entire lives and end up with very little. Others exploit that labor and end up with millions.
the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that my brother sweated for.
I've traveled round this country from shore to shining shore. It really made me wonder the things I heard and saw. I've seen my brothers working throughout this mighty land, and I prayed we'd get together and together make a stand.
But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that my brothers sweated for.
That we might own those banks of marble, with a guard at every door, and we would share those vaults of silver that we have sweated for.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.